Moral repression often breeds sexual creativity, and nowhere is this more true than in the South. In her new book, Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt, writer Susie Parker takes us on a private journey to an eccentric side of sin where Southerners secretly and not so secretly defy sexual convention. In a region where towns often have more churches than liquor stores, one encounters a host of unforgettable characters. Susie Parker joins us from her home in Little Rock by phone. She is an independent journalist and lifelong Southerner who lives and works in Little Rock. Her work has appeared in such diverse publications as The Economist, U.S. News and World Report, Penthouse, The Washington Post, The New York Times Magazine, and Salon.com. Sex in the South is her first book. Susie, welcome to Nonfiction and WBAI.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is this book about?
Well, the easiest way to say it is it's about sex in the South. I traveled 10 states interviewing people from all over about what they do, why they do it. It's a fun look. I didn't want to be academic. I didn't want to be serious. I didn't want to have footnotes. So it's a fun look, kind of my take on the people I met and what I saw.
And the book is written that way. It's written, organized by states and the kinds of people that you met in those places. And it's told through your own eyes of interacting with them. Not necessarily, it's a book about sex, and it's not necessarily you having sex with these people, but you observing them going through the various kinds of, I guess, sexually expressive behavior that they go through.
That's correct.
What kinds of people do you meet in the book, and did you meet in your travels?
One of the most interesting chapters in the whole book is in Alabama, and I think Alabama is the kinkiest, craziest state in all of the South.
Now, why do you say that?
I think I could have written this whole book in Alabama. I mean, everything is going on in Alabama. It is a haven for all things sexual. And when I started researching my book, I couldn't find really anything in Alabama. So I thought, well, you know, I can't write a book about the South and not include Alabama since it's right in the heart of Dixie.
Kind of like the buckle of the Bible Belt.
It is truly the buckle of the Bible Belt. And I think that's what makes it the most repressed state, but also the most sexually expressive state.
Now, I want to ask you more about that dynamic as we continue. But what kinds of things did you actually see there?
Well, in Alabama, I went undercover to a bondage club in rural Alabama, someplace that no one would ever think that they would even know what, you know, bondage is.
Now, when you say in rural Alabama, in other words, if we were to have driven along with you when we got to this place, what would we see looking around us?
A lot of trees, a lot of, it's not total rural Alabama, but I mean, it's pretty rural. I mean, you would see strip malls, you know, a Walmart, but it's rural. It's someplace, you know, it's not Atlanta or Birmingham. It's, you know, it's pretty small town. And
with its own bondage club.
With its own bondage scene. I mean, not just a club, just a scene. The whole, you know, there's people who come from all over the state to this place to, you know, indulge in.
Share the love, so to speak.
To share the love. To share the rotting crops.
Wow.
And the thing that struck me the most about these people were, I really thought that, you know, I had been to a bondage club in San Francisco, and it was more like a bar. It was just, you know, sexy goth kids who, you know, looked svelte and sexy in their black leather. These were people that could be anyone's parents or grandparents who could work in, you know, state government or who could work at the Walmart or who could work in the cubicle next to you. It was amazing. And they were the nicest people, some of the nicest people I'd ever met, you know, church-going citizens who, you know, this is what they do on Saturday nights. They live this total double life.
Susie, why did you write this book?
What really triggered this book was in 1997, I went to a sex toy party, which they are rampant in the South. It's very much like Tupperware parties, except a woman comes to your home and sells sex toys and lotions and potions. And it wasn't so much that I was shocked by this woman selling, you know, her sex toys. It was more that I was shocked that these were just normal suburban women, And the thing that really got me was when I asked them, you know, oh, so do your husbands know you're here tonight? They said, oh, no, we've been really naughty. We've lied to our husbands. And I said, oh, where do they think you are? And this woman, straight face, dead serious, says, Bible study. And that's when I kind of knew that what you see is never what you get, and I was going to explore it, you know, even more.
What is it that you feel makes the notion of a book about sex in the South compelling? That is, would a book titled Sex in the North possess whatever it is to which you feel your book, by virtue of its title, makes claim? In other words, the idea of sex in the South, what is the larger idea about the South that you feel that your book is making an allusion to and that you hope people will pick up?
Well, the South is the only region in the country called the Bible Belt. It's always been very conservative, and it's always had this image, I mean, going back to, you know, antebellum days, of women being prim and proper Southern belles and men being gentlemen. And, you know, you have conservative politicians coming out of the South. You have just this region that is bubbling over with this kind of oozy persona of sweetness and righteousness. And when you just kind of look under the surface, you see that it's not that at all, that it's totally a different world altogether. I mean, people have asked me that question before. Could I have written this book, you know, Sex in New England or Sex in the Midwest? And I'm sure all this stuff happens all over the world because, you know, sex is global. But I think it's in the South that people don't realize it's happening. If they think it's happening, they're in denial about it. They don't want to admit that it's happening. And
So it almost seems like what you're saying is that the South has a highest ratio of activity to denial.
Oh, I believe so. Definitely. Definitely.
In your book, you say, the South is a full-to-capacity carnal playground where the den mother buys dildos, the principal is a swinger, and the preacher is a porn fiend. This region I call home is a surreal bubbling cocktail of unbridled desire, uber Bible thumping, and unapologetic hypocrisy.
Yes, that's what I think it is. I think that is. I think that sums up the South. I think a perfect example is Strom Thurmond, who was, you know, the longtime senator from South Carolina, very much a segregationist, who now it's come to light that he was the father to a woman who is half black, half white. People would have never thought that. I mean, some people may not have ever thought it. With Strom Thurmond, it's this world of repression and rebellion that just feeds off each other all the time.
You also talk about Bill Clinton in the book, and very early. You call him the patron saint of Dixie, a walking, talking, ejaculating testament to the power of forgiveness. Now, you certainly have a way with words.
Thank you.
How was the Bill Clinton-Monica Lewinsky controversy seen in the South? In other words, what subtleties were plain to Southerners that Northerners might have overlooked?
I think that so many people in the country were, you know, so shocked by the whole Monica Lewinsky Oval Office situation, drama. But I think in the South, people were not so shocked. I think that they thought, oh, yeah. Granted, I live in Arkansas, so a lot of us had heard about Bill Clinton's liaisons for years, or they had, you know, they had bubbled up and through the years and had died down. And so you had the righteous people saying, oh, you know, how horrible. But I really think most Southerners thought, oh, yeah, sure, easy to believe. Of course he did it.
I mean,
the perfect example of that, the antithesis, is that we had in Arkansas a Republican senator who was in office during the whole impeachment process. And he would go on TV every night damning Clinton to hell, basically calling for, you know, his removal from office. And come to find out, he actually had an affair with a staffer and divorced his wife and married the staffer soon after all the impeachment stuff. So it's that double world again. I mean, everywhere you look, if you're looking, you know, hard enough, you can totally see it.
We're speaking with author Susie Parker. Her book is titled Sex in the South, Unbuckling the Bible Belt. And it's a look at the mores, the sexual mores of those people who live below the Mason-Dixon line here in the United States. I guess the question that keeps coming to me is, how did you write this book, given the absence of openness in the South about sexual matters?
Well, it was very interesting. I mean, at first, I would just blatantly approach someone either through email or by phone or, you know, in person, and I would just kind of ask them, you know, would you like to be interviewed for this book? And at first, some people were really kind of skittish, not so much about telling me about their sex lives, but they were more worried that I was going to judge them and then damn them to hell. And that's really what they were afraid of, that I was really going to do this whole judging thing and tell them why, you know, they were freaky or why they were going to hell. And
you mean in the process of actually doing the interview?
Exactly, that... yeah. They were worried about that and also worried about how they would turn out in the book. And finally, you know, I would just kind of convince them, look, you know, I've written all these sex stories before and I'm not out to judge anyone. I don't really care what you do. I just want to know, you know, how you do it and I guess why you do it, but more, you know, just as a curious person and not as, you know, some sort of Bible-thumping, you know, preacher. And once I kind of convinced a lot of people to talk to me, it just, people started opening up and they would refer me to other people to talk to. And I found that there was this real need in the South for people to talk about this, to really feel accepted and tell their story. And a lot of people, it was almost like a cleansing to go, oh, thank God, you know, someone actually wants to hear my story. And so I found once people opened up, they really, you know, couldn't shut up.
Mm.
And that's what I'm finding now with the feedback from the book. I mean, people will, they want to go out for coffee, they want to talk about the book, they want to invite me to book club.
So doing the book and having people open up to you in the book has then created a secondary effect of more openness.
Indeed.
Mm.
I mean, it's really, at first, when people first started reading the book, I would get emails, and then, but now people just walk up to me and say, oh, you know, I've read the book, and, you know, I want you to come to book club and talk about this, which I thought would never happen in the South, that this book would be read at book club, and women would actually want to, you know, talk about it. And it's a pretty amazing process. I mean, I'm finding people really want to talk about sex down here, and they want a legitimate reason to do it so they don't feel guilty or naughty for doing it.
One of the most interesting chapters in the book is titled Magically Delicious Southern Charms, and it takes place in Pell City, Alabama, which, again, you say is ground zero for sex in the South, I guess you
might say. I believe so.
Tell us what happened in that chapter.
Well, in that chapter, I went to Pell City, which is very, it also is very rural Alabama. It's right outside Birmingham. They just recently even got a Walmart, so it's very small town South. And this group of women called Southern Charms met there for a bash. They call them a bash, and it's Southern Charms actually from all over the country, but mostly this bash had Southern Charms mostly from the South. And they get together, and they have porn shoots. I mean, they're amateur porn stars, housewives, PTA moms, makeup saleswomen, you name it. And they get together, and they have these porn shoots, and the fans that go to their website.
Now, by porn shoots, you mean that they
shoot pictures and, yeah, with each other, with their husbands, or it's just kind of this all-out kind of orgy situation. That's probably the most shocking chapter, I think, in the whole book.
And why do you say it's the most shocking?
I guess I just was not expecting to ever find myself at a, you know, kind of porn photo shoot in rural Alabama with a bunch of PTA moms. It was just surreal and weird. And they're totally not shy, no holds bar, show you everything, triple X kind of porn, and think nothing about it. It's
and they
amazing.
Put this up on their websites for people to get access to on the basis of membership.
That's right.
In the,
there's thousands of these women.
I remember there's a part where you find, first of all, a one woman being photographed, and it's almost as though someone blew like a silent whistle or something like that. It's like a cue, and everybody just starts taking off their clothes and going at it almost.
Right, right. And it's outside, and this, you couldn't get more Alabama than this. I mean, it's outside on at a lake house, and outside of the lake house it's like this little shack kind of place on the lake, and there's like this trailer and kind of hound dogs running around, and there's a Alabama flag and an RV. I mean, it's totally rural Alabama. I mean, you can't get any more rural than that. And they're just taking off their clothes. And these are not necessarily all the time sexy women. I mean, some, you know, are overweight, and some are not just the most sexiest women you're ever going to see. But they have no, I mean, they're not embarrassed. This is what they do. This is what they are into. And they love it. And their husbands are supportive, and they make a lot of money doing it.
When you ask people who engaged in all of these activities, whether it was swinging or stripping, bondage, whatever, what reasons did they give for why they did what they did?
A lot of them said that they, you know, it made them feel, it makes them feel sexy, it turns them on, it's their fetish, it's their thing. I think a lot of them, though, while they didn't exactly say it in so many words, I totally got the feeling that a lot of these people were rebelling against something in society or something in their own life or something in their, you know, in their family life. Maybe they grew up in a strict household, that kind of thing, and they're rebelling. Now, I think some of them, you know, do what they do because they love it. But I think that underneath a lot of it, it's a rebellion. It's rebellion.
When did you start to realize that some of the reasons that you were hearing were some of your own for writing the book?
Well, I totally knew when I started writing this book that I was rebelling against against the South and against the kind of strict society that we live in. And so I knew when I started writing this book, it was no doubt I was rebelling. I was rebelling against you know, people who thought that a single girl couldn't write about sex, rebelling against kind of the mores of the region. And I knew that it would probably stir up some people, but I was also hoping that, you know, it would get people talking.
And that it certainly has.
I think so.
What does your book say about race?
Well, I don't go so much into race in this book, and there's no particular reason that I don't. It just, you know, the people I met were the people I met and decided to interview. One thing it does say about race is that I found, and this is by no means, you know, supposed to be funny, it just kind of is, that that blacks in the South are not into bondage at all, which is kind of, you know, I never even thought about it before I wrote this book, but when I went to the bondage club, I realized there were just no blacks, and they said, oh, well, you know, if you were in the South and you were black, would you want to be tied up and whipped? And so it was kind of this, you know, throwback to, you know, slavery. I really think that in the South, blacks may be more open about sex. I think they're a little more in tune to their kind of sexual beings than whites. I really think so.
Did you find African Americans in any of these scenes that you covered? Was there a lot of interracial mixing in, whether it was stripping or wife swapping, or did you see that, or did they tend to be white scenes almost exclusively?
Well, the strip clubs go either way. I mean, it can be African American or it can be white, Hispanic. I mean, the strippers themselves and the patrons of the strip clubs.
But those are clubs.
Those are clubs.
But when you're talking about those scenes that gather around people's homes or in people's backyards,
those are definitely segregated. Definitely. The only thing that's really, now I have to say that the sex toy parties, some of them, not so much in this chapter that I wrote for the book, but I have been to several of them, and they can be, you know, half African American, half white. Because a lot of women invite their coworkers, and, you know, they just, I don't think that they really think a lot about race at all. They think more about, oh, let's just invite women and no men.
Mm-hmm.
But in houses, I would say that it's still pretty segregated.
Why?
Well, I think the South is still segregated. I mean, I think that we like to think it's not, and we all have African-American friends, and African-Americans work with whites. But I think that when it comes to social situations in a lot of towns, especially if you're in a small city, you tend to see it be so much more just white or black. And And I still think we have a long way to go with race relations in the South. I mean, we still have African-American funeral homes down here where, you know, blacks want to be buried by a black funeral home and whites want to be buried by a white funeral home. So we've got a long way to go down here.
What do you think is at the root of the Southern form of sexual repression that is, to a great extent, the basis of your book?
I think what is at the very root of it is church, is God. It's hard to get away from church and God down here. Even if you don't go to church, it's hard. I have friends who are atheists who don't go to church but still feel guilty in some way for not going to church, or at least feel like an outsider. Because one of the first questions that people ask you in the South when you move to a new town is, where do you go to church? It's one of the first questions out of anyone's mouth. And I think that at the heart of all this sexual repression is church and the this kind of damning to hell that if you don't toe the line, you're going straight to hell. And I think that that feeds into so many aspects of society down here that it breeds this repression that in turn, you know, creates this rebellion.
But where did that come from? In other words, people go to church everywhere on the planet or to some place, but not every place is like this. So what is it in the Southern mind that turned God and church into this kind of an anvil, if you will?
I don't know. I've done a lot of research on Southern studies and Southern culture, and I think, I mean, it goes way back. I think it goes back to the South having always been just about a rural area, and you know, except for a few cities that come to mind, like Atlanta and Charleston, New Orleans, you have this vast, I mean, granted, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years, we've all, you know, we now have a Walmart in the town and whatever, but you had this vast rural area for so long that wasn't really metropolitan or cosmopolitan, and so church became this focus. And I think through the years, it's continued, and there's just this building of religion, and that's why we have the Bible Belt. And it's just kind of grown into this epic place of God and where sin and guilt is pounded into people so much more.
I wonder to what degree the South's history of slavery has anything to do with this. That is to say, because of the fact that slavery was a system that involved an awful lot of repression of various kinds, both repression of, to begin with, the ambitions of African Americans or blacks or the slave property of the slave masters, but then also the slave master had to repress an awful lot as well to live with people but act as though they weren't human beings.
Yeah, I think that it goes, I think this, the whole South, you know, has issues, and I think it does go back, I think it probably does go back to slavery, and the South has always been, this double world. I mean, you know, even going back to antebellum times, you talking about slavery. I mean, you know, slaves had to play by the rules or, you know, be punished. And slave masters were, you know, in control, but yes, like you said, had to repress. And Southern belles are brought up to be very, you know, proper and prim and play by the rules and not rock the boat. And I think that through the years, it's just kind of culminated, and it's handed down through generations that you know, you don't rebel. Although, and the twist to that is that, you know, the South is known as the land of, you know, rebel yells and the Confederate flag. And so in one way, Southerners rebel. And then in another way, they want to pretend to be very, you know, prim and proper and, you know, righteous and, you know, not rebel.
I think the obvious question I have to ask you is, with this critique of the South and with your criticisms of it and with the repression that you recognize, why do you still live there and I guess still love being there? Why have you not, like in the book you say a lot of your friends encourage you to get out as fast as possible, but the impression I get is that this is a place that you consider very close to your heart and that if not for some other reason, you probably would be content to spend your life there.
I think you're right. I think I'm very much like Scarlett O'Hara and Gone with the Wind. I'm tied to the land in some way that makes it impossible for me to leave the South. I mean, I'm Southern through and through. That being said, you know, it can really drive a person crazy living down here. I travel a lot, so I get out of the South frequently, so that's healthy. But I think that it's also such a rich playground for a writer to be, because you have so many characters and you have so many issues that are, you know, kind of brewing down here that you never run out of anything to write about. And I think that's probably the real reason that I stay, because I'm so fascinated by the South.
Yes, it's a region of characters, they say.
It is.
We've been speaking with author Susie Parker. Her book is titled Sex in the South: Unbuckling the Bible Belt, and that it indeed does. It unbuckles it, and whether you like what you see or not, you'll definitely have your eyes opened. Susie Parker is an independent journalist and lifelong Southerner who lives and works in Little Rock, Arkansas. And you can read more about Sex in the South and about Susie on her website, which is at Susie Parker, that's SusieParker. SusieParker.com. Susie Parker, thank you for being our guest today on Nonfiction.
Thanks so much for having me.